You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
Michael.
Clink, clink, clank. There's certain times that I feel like filling glasses at a certain level and then getting like a chopstick and giving a ding, dang, dong, dong. Now I feel like Donald Trump. Sorry.
Yeah, that was sorry. mildly racist, but we'll let it slide.
No, it wasn't racist. It was Trump these days is doing the ting tang tong thing.
Oh my God! Can we just no? This is a Donald Trump free zone.
All right.
Okay, so I'm actually really excited about what we're doing today. I'm a big fan of stories. I'm a big fan of like those urban legends that get out of hand and become larger than life, like Ford v Ferrari. Did you see the movie?
I did.
That is one of my favorite like stories that exist. And
did you see the movie Ferrari? Just the Ferrari movie?
I have not seen just the Ferrari movie. Oh. I saw the Lamborghini movie, which was terrible because that's another story that I love.
Ferrari was a good movie. Good movie.
So, just to summarize, Ford v Ferrari. Like what happened was in the 1960s, the Ford Motor Company, like pickup trucks and, you know, police cars, the Ford Interceptor, like this company was getting ready to save Ferrari from financial ruin. We're about to buy Ferrari. And Enzo Ferrari, like on the day the contract was supposed to be signed, basically said, screw you guys, and sent them packing back to Detroit. And what happened in the 1960s, and I'm sorry, I'm not spoiling the movie. Still go see the movie.
And do you know who bought?
Fiat saved Ferrari, but the
so now you've got to watch. You actually have to watch Ferrari as the movie to get the compendium.
Get the other part. Okay,
yes.
Okay, so I'm going to watch Ferrari after this. What happened after this was that Henry Ford II, the son of Edsel Ford, the grandson of Henry Ford, decided to embarrass and destroy Ferrari and went all out and developed the Ford GT40. One of the greatest cars to ever exist on this planet. Won the 24 Hours of Le Mans 3 years in a row, 66, 67, 68. Maybe it was 4 years in a row. Either way, just this whole idea that being insulted by Enzo Ferrari was enough to just go all out. So a lot of you sitting here listening to this podcast right now are wondering, Andre, what does Ford v Ferrari have to do about wine?
What does Ferrari have to do with anything? Well, actually, Ferrari has a lot to do with wine. They actually make wine.
Well, there we go, but so that's not where we're going.
Makes great sparkling wine if you can get your hands on it.
Okay.
It's not inexpensive, too. It's like $25.
Now I actually feel like this is an episode of The Muppet Show and we're Statler and Waldorf here.
It's time to play the music. It's time to light the lights.
So we're about to interview the winemaker from Penfolds.
Yes.
And Penfolds is another winery that has that great story. I've been lucky enough. Have you tasted the Grange?
I don't know if I've tasted a Grange. I've tasted a DRC.
I've got to taste Grange. Do you know the story behind Grange?
It's tickling the back of my mind, but I'll let you tell it.
I'm going to see if Andrew will tell us like his version. So I'm going to go through like the long and short of it. Is that basically and he'll correct me on my
There's dates. A secret part of me hoping that you're so wrong and that he tells a story that is so different from what you're
so I'm hoping the story's correct, but the dates might be wrong. Is in about the 1950s, everything in Australia was making sweet wine. They were making port style wines and not making dry table wines. And the winemaker at the time at Penfolds had kept aside some clandestine barrels that eventually became the Grange. And when those wines saw the light of day, got the international accolades, got the local accolades, then Penfolds, it essentially redirected the direction of the company. So I've been enamored with the story. I've been fortunate enough. I got to taste the wine when I went to Robert Mondavi. That was part of their Tokalon program. One of the wines they let you taste is the Grange. And it's actually the thing where I wish I had a time machine, because I remember when I started to learn about the Grange. I remember reading about it in Drops of God, the great manga that I've recommended on this, and a show on Apple as well, is the wines were going for about $500, $400 a bottle, which still a lot of money.
Mm.
But current vintages of the Grange that roll through the LCBO are trading at like $2,000.
Yep.
And like at that point, it's hard to justify spending the money.
So, do you want to stop burying the lead and tell everybody what we're doing here now?
I already did. I said we're interviewing the winemaker from Penfolds.
Correct, but now we're going to taste the wines that showed
up.
Oh!
Yeah, but we don't have a bottle of the Grange, so no, we're going to bury the lead on that.
Grange, but so we're going to taste the wines before we talk to the winemaker, and then that way we are prepared for what he's going to be talking about. And so during the interview, when you hear us talking about the wines, you will know that secretly, we've already tasted them. So we'll fake it with him. So the first wine that we actually have here is a Bin 311 Chardonnay. Andre saw this and suddenly became very excited.
Actually, that's not true. That's not true. I asked questions about whether or not this was going to be over-the-top, obnoxious Chardonnay, because
that is the legacy, I guess, right now.
Well, and the thing is, like, we've tasted the Wakefield Chardonnay, which is, like, it's good, but it's also, like, $20-odd a bottle, and it still has a little bit of...
I've liked a few of the Wakefields a little bit better lately. It is... what I've noticed is that for the most part, Australia is starting to pull back from oak, which we have talked about many times, is a universal thing within the wine world, which is good. So here we are with the 311, the 2022.
This is big. This is a big wine.
I can still smell the butterscotch, the vanilla,
but it does also have like citrus, but it's hard citrus. It's like lemon. But it's also like it's Meyer lemon, like just a little bit of sweetness to it.
Yeah, there's some fruit here, but it's still no pun intended, mired in oak.
Okay. You are on the tail end of a head cold. I'm going to give you a slight mulligan on this, and this is one where I need you to trust me. I know you don't usually defer to, you blew your nose and had a bit of a reaction. I'm not going to lie and say, like, this is what I imagine when I imagine warm climate Chardonnay. But the acid is really nice on it.
Yeah, see, they're starting to learn to deal with some of that acidity. And it's... I really like the Wakefields lately, the way they're handling the Chardonnay. The 1695 Chardonnay has been really good the last two vintages. This one's not bad. Like, it's still... There's still a little bit of that vanilla cream kicking around in here, but...
But it's lifted.
But it's not as heavy on the tongue that...
It's lifted.
Well, if that's what you want to call it.
Yeah.
It's not overpowering the wine. I could drink this.
Are we going to do thumbs up or thumbs down, or do we think that's not fair in case we're going to crap on a bunch of wines and talk to the winemaker?
We're not going to crap on that.
For me, this wine says guilty pleasure. This is not, like, my cellar's gone really cool climate in terms of Chardonnay, but this is one where I crave wines like this once in a while. This is a thumbs up for me.
There's a part of me that wants to go down, but there's also a part of me that wants to go up. And then you told me there's no
waffling.
No waffling. And that was my own rule as well. I'm going to go up. I think for the most part, it's because of what expectations were and what the reality is.
Yeah, I mean, this is not like an everyday Chardonnay, and like, don't go into this expecting Burgundy. This is unapologetic Australia,
California kind, but still with, it's not Kistler.
No.
Which is where, you know, just, you know, clobbered with oak. This is, it's not Mare Soleil, which is, again, terribly oaky. It has fruit. It's got a nice balance to it. There's some nice components here that I'm liking.
Ooh, look at the color on this.
So this is a dark Cabernet Shiraz.
Bin 389.
Bin 389, 2020, I think.
Yep. This is what I was looking forward to, because when I think of Penfolds, I think about big red wines.
I'll tell you, that's... Wow, that's the smell on it. Granted, it's cut through the head cold. Yes, I did blow the nose a little bit. Yeah, this is that mocha white pepper.
Oh, cassis, like super. This reminds me of black currant jam.
There's some chocolate kicking around in this too. This is hedonistic wine,
but it doesn't feel. Whew, it doesn't feel over the top. Like, there's some nice smoke to it. There is like some charred cedar.
You have the bottle on your side. What's the alcohol? I want to say it's 14.5, but I would not. If you could lie to me and tell me it's 13.5.
It's 51% Cabernet Sauvignon, 49% Shiraz. It's 14.5 alcohol.
Yeah, there's a. There's a lot going on in here. Wow. It's a big thumbs up. Let's start there.
Yeah, this is definitely a big thumbs up. See, this is the one where we talk about the direction that world winemaking is taking. Is like there is definitely a lot of barrel influence on this, but it's not overly barrel. No,
but that fruit is forefront. And one of the things that I learned when I was in Cyprus is one of the winemakers said, if the wine has fruit, then it'll age. If it's got spice or wood or oak, it won't. And he said it this way. He said, if you put an apple or if you put a strawberry on your counter and just let it age, you know, things will happen to it. You know, it'll change. But if you put a piece of spice or a piece of wood on your counter, what happens? Nothing. And there's fruit forefront here, and then there's that spicy oaky characteristic that sits at the bottom, or at the base of this wine, and I do believe that this will age gracefully, really well. This is wow.
I think this has a really long life ahead of it, but I also think that this is definitely approachable in its youth.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would do with a bit of decanting, like.
Yeah, there's
the tannin's starting to hit my inner cheeks. Well, I feel like I've been sucking on some cotton balls.
Yeah, there's definitely a coffee note to it. There's that mocha, the chocolate, the dark chocolate. That's really a lovely wine. You can see with a wine like that why Penfolds has the reputation it does for red wines.
I mean, I'll be honest,
even not the Grange.
It's no Grange.
No, but I mean,
if you can't afford $2,000 for Grange, $100 on this is like
that's a lovely piece of winemaking.
All right. So we've got, I think, what might be a bit of a unicorn in our head, because I certainly wasn't expecting this when Mark Anthony helped us line up this interview.
You looked in the bag and you said there's a champagne from Penfolds, and I'm like. It's a sparkling wine. And then you said, no, it's champagne. A champagne. And you handed me the bottle, and champagne is written right in the middle of it. And I'm like, what the hell is this? So I guess we're going to have questions.
Yeah, Andrew will have to do some splaining.
But here we go. This is an actual champagne, and it's a rosé.
All right, let me inspect the bottle. You inspect the wine. I'll inspect the bottle. Let's see if we can get to the bottom.
It definitely is a pink wine.
So reading the bottle top to bottom, Champagne Tiano. So there's the Champagne House, ex Penfolds, an extraordinary collaboration. Champagne Brut Rosé, product of France. On the back, Champagne Brut Rosé. Oh, I hate it when this happens. Like, there is literally... There's no story. Like, you know how you get those like crappy teaser trailers like 2 years before a movie comes out?
We got to figure out what's going on here, because this...
Okay, so it does say cuvée selected by Penfolds.
Okay, so...
So I'm...
But it is a Brut Rosé, so let's start there.
But it also means it's Champagne Brut Rosé, which means either Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, this is like really red and juicy. See, I hate a lot of champagne, rosé champagne, because I like rosé sparkling wines to be a little bit more opulent and juicy. And usually, like, when we taste the really good stuff, like Krug Rosé, which I've tasted a few times, is like, what's the point? It's pink, but it doesn't smell like raspberries or cherries anymore.
Yeah, there's a real nice... Yeah, this has got some really nice notes to it. Some strawberry. There's a little bit, like a hint of cherry. There's some red currants.
That's a lot of raspberry for me. All right, I have more questions than answers, but we're not going to get to them from tasting
this. Not
here,
but I know you hate when I do this, but that's a Lionel Richie wine.
Oh, my God.
All night long, baby.
Oh, my God.
That's also got me dancing on the ceiling as well. So that's, I really like that one.
You mean like Christopher Walken in Weapon of Choice?
No, that's also a Lionel Richie song. Sorry.
Can we update your pop culture references?
Oh, no, I had to go with that one. That one was really good.
Okay, I know I have to up my game now that I have a little girl, that I have to up my dad joke game, because like we've been doing this podcast for like 5+ years and all your pop culture references are like, they're so Gen X, they hurt.
Oh. This is the Eras Tour, baby. How's that? Want me to bring it right in there? This is really good. This is really good. I'm ready.
So you've gone from Lionel Richie to Tay Tay?
Yeah.
You're a Taylor Swift fan?
No. I am not. I like some of her stuff, but
okay.
You know what, I have nothing against, like, all the power to her, man. Like, she is...
Oh, she's printing money.
She's, you know, rule the world. Go for it.
Okay, can I tell you what I did today?
Do I want to know?
I'm actually, like, I'm really, really pleased. And it's one of my favorite things of living in Hamilton, because I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast live in the Niagara region. And I was a proud Torontonian until I moved to Hamilton. It kind of grew on me. Sum 41 announced their last concerts in Toronto, and... Earlier this week, and when you're listening to this, it's definitely been a few weeks past, but earlier this week, they announced the last leg of their Canadian tour. One of the places they're playing is in St. Catharines.
Really? Where?
And I got four
tickets. Is it like the Meridian Center?
Four tickets to see Gob opening for Sum 41 at the Meridian Center, and I'm really excited to live down here.
Well, the Bare Naked Ladies are showing up too, so there you go.
I don't mind the Bare Naked Ladies, but it's just like, you know, Michael, sometimes I forget that you're like just 10 years older.
You know, Rod Stewart showing up at the OLG.
Oh,
right?
My God.
All right. So coming up is our interview with Andrew from Penfolds.
We're now joined by Andrew Baldwin. He is one of the senior winemakers at Penfolds. Michael, you and I have just tasted through a small lineup of Penfolds wines. So a special thanks to Mark Anthony for getting us. I guess, Andrew, what you and I were talking about off microphone here as Baby Grange is what you said.
Correct. So it's,
and that's
basically
a Bin 389.
Yes, correct. So which is a Cabernet Shiraz. So it's called Baby Grange or Poor Man's Grange. So anything that I guess the realms of the story came about when Max Schubert, the founder of Penfolds Grange, or the creator, it was creating Grange first, and then after Grange, after he created the top echelon of wine first, he decided to create wines underneath it. So to protect Grange, anything that didn't quite make the top echelon would fall down into 389. So hence the name Baby Grange.
So what can you explain what the either the origin or why you call these wines? Everything's in bin. So where does the bin idea come from?
The bin comes from the underground drives. So obviously wineries many years ago, even here in Australia, were underground cellars. So all the wines were stored in the underground, what we call drives. And each one of the drives had a number. They called it a bin. So a batch identification number. So, you know, when Max would put... And same as what your credit card is these days. Everything's got a bin number on it as well. You know, they're batch identification numbers. So basically underground, originally it was bin 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then Max would store the wines in bin 1. So it was easy for him to say, can you go to bin 1 and take out the 1951 Grange, please? and they would bring it up to Max in the winery. So the bins were originally where their storage origins were at McGill Estate Winery, which is the home, the original home of Penfolds in Adelaide, South Australia.
Well, there we go. That makes sense. I mean, that's sort of what I would have guessed the story would be. Yeah. One thing I do want to just get like off the table here at the beginning is in the tasting part of the podcast that you didn't hear, Michael and I were talking about the origin story of Grange, and that's just one of my favorite like mythical stories of, you know, sort of happy accidents or clandestine winemaking. But I was just wondering if you could clear the record and tell us in your words or the Penfolds words, like what happened? How did the Grange come to be?
Well, it was originally obviously Max Schubert was the original and first chief winemaker of the company. So outside of a family member making wine for Penfolds, and the origins of Penfolds were fortified wines. So outside of the family, Max Schubert, a local Barossa Valley boy, started working for the company as a paper boy, and then obviously graduated into winemaking, did his degree, and then basically had an idea. He got sent by the business to Portugal and Spain to study the origins of fortified. But he had this really interest on what was happening in Bordeaux. So on his trip, he decided to call back through Bordeaux and look at all of the first growths. So, and he had the same idea. You know, his origins were wanting to produce wines like Bordeaux that were crafted for time. So the timeless wines. So he had this big interest of creating a wine that was based in Australia from what we actually had here. And most of the varieties here at the time were obviously the Rhone varieties. So they were planted from fortified origins, so from the southern part of Rhone. So we had lots of Shiraz, we had Mataro, we had obviously lots of Grenache. So he was trying to adapt an idea, and he thought of Penfolds Grange, which is actually made from Syrah grape, because that was the variety that was planted here in Australia, I guess the largest variety planted here in this part of the world. So, and with obviously warm conditions that Australia has in this part of the world as well. So his origins were just to start and produce a wine that had the longevity. And hence he formulated Penfolds Grange. And then we have the stories where, you know, in the company decided that they didn't want Max to create Grange anymore. So 57, 58 and 59, he was told to stop making Grange. So the end of 1956, because I guess journalists at the time were saying, why would anybody buy a dry still wine, let alone drink it? You know, of large tannin and you know, sort of big flavour. So he was just told to stop making the wine. So he crafted the wines in secret in the McGills of McGill Estate, away from prying eyes and away from the family. So he crafted 1957, 58 and 59 in secret. And then in 1960, the three vintages were released at the same time. So, but the family decided that it did really well overseas in basically show wine. So I think the Olympiad in Paris, it did very, very well. So the company and the family decided to create the wines again. But Max, unbeknown to them, had the 57, 58 and 59 all cellared. So they're actually quite rare and quite hard to find Granges as well.
So what is the first year of the Grange?
1951 was when it was first. There was a, and they're the rarest of obviously all. You know, the first and the smallest batch that was probably ever produced was the 1951. And really for the first 10 years, Max gave a lot of it away. You know, a lot of it was given to friends, and that's why we generally tend to see you know, these wonderful old Granges in people's, because they're all given to Max's friends and acquaintances, and they were all put away because nobody at that particular time knew what the wine was all about. So people just, you know, hid them away. And today, you know, you'll see a 1951 here in Australia sell for $180,000 Australian dollars.
I was just going to say, I found a bottle on winesearcher.com of one bottle of the 1951 Penfolds Grange at a German wine shop in Hamburg. and it's listed at $131,000.
Yes. And,
US,
and look,
US or Euro?
That's Canadian. $131,000 Canadian. It does the conversion. It looks like 1952 was a little bit more accessible, but I mean, we can get one from Langton's Fine Wines. Do you know that,
yes.
that shop? Okay.
Yes.
So they've got
Langton's,
a bottle.
We do a lot with Langton's.
So they've got a bottle for only $22,000 Canadian. It's just chump change, right, Michael?
Yeah, we're pooling our money for that one.
But then he also did things like Grange has always been Syrah or Shiraz. So with small amounts of Cabernet added into it. But in 1953, it's the only one that's ever been done. You can find a Shiraz Grange and you can find a Cabernet Grange. The only time it's ever been done in 70-odd years. So the 1953 Cabernet Grange is much more valuable than the Shiraz because it's a one-off, only one was ever created.
I love
so,
that.
You know,
has there ever been a thought of doing that again, just for the fun of it?
There's always thoughts, Michael. and I guess that was Max's legacy as well. He always wanted, you know, younger winemakers, the winemaking team, to come into the harvest, come into the vintage with new ideas every single year. So he challenged the winemaking team to create different things over the new harvests coming out every single year. So he was certainly a dynamic person as well. So,
That's okay. So the good news is I got most of the story correct. I didn't get I didn't mention anything about the Bordeaux side of it. So you definitely gave a bit more texture to the story, but like it's a really cool story.
Yeah. I mean, he just wanted to, you know, be sure that he was crafting wines, and he always had this idea of, and in that time when he was traveling in France, I think it was 1948, 48, 49, he actually saw a large vintage, and they were actually, to save space in the winery, they're actually finishing the fermentation, which is not a usual thing in Bordeaux. They were finishing the fermentation in barrels because they'd run out of space. So they didn't have any space, so they're actually finishing their because generally they'll actually finish their fermentation to dry on skins. But because they were so constricted for room, he saw them running wine off at sweetness, still with sugar in it, into a barrel. So all our Grange, still to this day, is run off with sugar in it and finish the fermentation in a barrel. So we don't ferment to dryness in Australia with Shiraz. We actually only go down to around 2 Beaumé because we've extracted all of the colour in the first 8-9 days of fermentation. Then once there's a little bit of sugar in, we put it to an American oak barrel to finish as a fermentation. We believe we get wonderful integration with the oak rather than the still wine just sitting there. The fermentation, the warmth, the depth, it actually heats the barrel a little bit and draws a lot more from the actual barrel, and you get this much better integration of oak and fruit at the same time. So all of our Grange and all of our 707 and parts of Little Baby Grange are finished fermentation in a American oak barrel.
That does explain a little bit there, Andre, as far as the when we tasted the wine that we were mentioning that it, while it had oak characteristics, it wasn't overly oaky.
No, the balance was great, like smoke notes. But the thing is, I would have never guessed American oak on this. Like, has it always been American oak, or is that something that evolved?
100%.
That's fascinating to me.
100%. So it's finished in a 100% American oak fermentation, and then maturated for another. Well, you know, it's 18 to 24 months maturation. All 100% American oak. So we rack. Once it's finished fermentation, once it's gone through its malolactic fermentation, we rack out of the barrel and put it back to the same barrels.
And is it? It's not all new barrels, I must assume.
100% new. Yes.
Wow.
So really, it's about the concentration of fruit. So what we see here in Australia in some of our vineyards, it's all about the concentration of fruit. So we see much smaller berries. But what we're seeing also is because we're not governed by appellation, we're able to source fruit from everywhere. So what we tend to have is we have a little region to the north of us called Clare, we have McLaren Vale just to the south of the city of Adelaide. And Matt's, in his wisdom, through his when he became chief winemaker, he actually planted vineyards within all these different regions. So spreading the risk, but he wanted characters from all those different regions. McLaren Vale is by the coast. You know, Clare is inland, but a very narrow, cool, small region. And then Coonawarra is 5 hours south of, you know, great for Cabernet. So he wanted to spread the risk, but what he did was take elements from all those different regions, and all those different elements come together for one great thing, which is Grange. So you're looking for all the different elements. Clare's got wonderful aromatics. McLaren Vale has some lovely earthiness and spiciness, and Barossa Valley has the richness, you know, has the depth and the darkness. So all these little things put together, it's about winemakers then being able to blend and coming up with the creation of Grange. So yeah, it's understanding what you're looking for in those elements.
And Andrew, these interviews are always the ones that are the most fun, because Michael and I haven't had to really ask you anything. We've sort of just mentioned the word Grange and things have popped off.
So here. Sorry.
No, it's a good thing. So
I guess one thing that I've also done is I've worked with some of the past winemakers. So next year I'll be with the business for 40 years.
Holy smoke.
So I've created and crafted some of these wonderful wines from, you know, the past winemakers. So I've learned from a gentleman called John Bird, who was the senior winemaker manager with Matt Schubert. And he spent 60 years with the business. You know, my ex-senior winemaker, he was 40 years with the business. So it's learning from these gentlemen that are traditional, and, you know, part of our business is, you know, there's all these different varieties and other things happening in the world of wine, but people expect Grange to look the same as it was in 1951, 1955, you know, 1995, 2005. So it's all about the thumbprint and the blueprint, how we do it. You know, the technology is a little different now. You know, we use stainless steel. Back in McGill, they were 5-ton concrete waxed fermenters. Now it's just stainless steel. So, but we use the same technique, but it's just stainless steel, not concrete. So we've had to expand, obviously. So the expansion is not done with concrete and wax anymore. It's expanded with stainless steel. So they're the only things that have really changed. You know, the technique of crafting Penfolds has always been about the DNA. It's always been about following that map, following that DNA, following that thumbprint of what Penfolds is all about. And that was crafted by Max and instilled in the rest of the winemaking team.
It's amazing to hear about all these guys that have been there like 60 years.
Yeah,
40 years.
I was just thinking,
like, there's some longevity in this company. Like, it's not just guys who show up for 5 years and then take off.
No, it's part of your DNA. I mean, you know, I think when I was, you know, 20 years ago, someone said, you know, you should go to a different part and get some more experience in a, you know, more commercial winery. And I said, I can get the experience here. But for me, it's about the love of wine and crafting the best wine that this company, this country has to offer. You know, the really true first growth in this country is Penfolds Grange. So for me, it's all about the love of it, the, you know, why I've been here so long. It's about the wine itself. It's about the history. It's about those people that, you know, that I fell in love with, and those stories that I heard as well, and maintaining that as well, not changing it. I still love to craft it, and there's talk about it all of the time. You know, whether it's outside our business or whether it's inside our business, there's just so much focus on Penfolds and Penfolds Grange. You know, there's always talk about the chief winemaker. The chief winemaker now is a gentleman called Peter Gago. So he's been with the business for 30 years now. So, you know, I've worked with Peter for all that amount of time as well. So we took over from John DeVale. So there's only ever been four chief winemakers. So Max Schubert, Don Ditter, John DeVale, and now Peter Gago. So in the whole history of the 180 years. So this year is our actually 180th birthday.
Wow.
So there's a lot of celebrations around the world, and hence why I was in Montreal in Canada only, you know, 6 weeks ago. You know, it's about traveling the world, especially once we finished harvest here in Australia. We'll be out celebrating our 180th birthday.
Wow. Our invitation must have gotten lost in the mail for that one.
Well, that was Montreal. We were Toronto.
I guess.
So anyway, sure, they're coming to Toronto at some point.
So, Andrew, let me just ask you a bit about like your career, because like Michael, you and I, we talked about the wines before. I'm really curious. Like, I have this wealth of knowledge in front of us here. Like, you're not just someone who's only been with the company 5-10 years or whatever. Like, you've seen it all.
Correct.
What do you think is where does Australian wine exist in the world now? Like is it established as a premium thing? And not just Penfolds Grange, because like that is what it is. That's why we were excited to talk to you. But like Australian wine as an entity, like what is the state of the union for Australian wine right now?
I guess the state of the union at the moment is we were heavily exporting to China. And the China market, obviously, I'm not sure if you've heard or other parts of the world have heard, but we had a tariff placed on Australian wine. So at the moment, we have a lot of surplus wine because we're not exporting to China, because China placed a 220% tariff on Australian wine. Australia asked for the Australian government at the time in 2020 asked for the origins of COVID, and that being China, you know, to investigate the World Health Organization, to investigate that. So, and then they decided to place bans on all Australian products going into China. And obviously being such a close, a neighbor to Australia, you know, we had wine, wheat, you know, barley, oats, all those sorts of things. Seafood is a huge exporter into China. They place bans on seafood, live export, and meat and all those sorts of things. So I think this month, by the end of the month, which is not very far away, China is supposed to lift those bans. So it's been nearly 3.5 years since those bans came into place. So it's obviously placed pressure on the Australian wine industry. So, but it's enabled someone like Penfolds. I mean, I can only speak about Penfolds a little bit. I know the smaller guys and the smaller businesses have really struggled. There's wineries, there's vineyards for sale. There's, you know, the commercial section here. Obviously, there's a heavily irrigated section, very much in the middle, sort of northern parts of Victoria, over the border from South Australia. That are really suffering, because a lot of that commercial wine was making its way via bulk wine onto the Chinese market. So that's sort of obviously disappeared, and the wine prices or the grape prices have actually come down. But what we've seen post-COVID is that, you know, the high-end ultra-premium wines like Penfolds and some of the other brands as well have gone up. Because during COVID, people were obviously bound in their homes, so they actually consumed higher-end wines. They weren't spending money, so let's buy wines. We can get wines into the house. Let's buy wines at a higher-end price. So, and that's drifted on post-COVID. So we're finding that, you know, things like Grange and our 707 and Baby Grange 389 and 407 is actually, we're actually making more of it. So, so we've actually been in that target, because a lot of our wines are at the higher price and the premium end of the market. So we've actually found ourselves requiring more. So, but people have found it tough, and it's been a tough market for the last 3.5 to 4 years. So, we're in the market of making more. It's actually expanded our into Southeast Asia. So places like Korea and Japan, we've actually exported more into those countries and gone back into those countries. You know, we sort of left Japan on the back burner for a little while, and now we've actually spent a lot more time in Japan and places like that. You know, Thailand, all the Southeast Asian countries. Taiwan is a big importer of Australian wine. So those sorts of things have been happening.
And the Canadian market, have we made up with our Australian friends? I know there was a bit of a trade dispute a few years ago between us
with the submarine.
It was something to do with taxation and exports and this and that. And
no, Australia sued us to get into the market better.
Yeah, so I guess the yes, but hence our push into the market, the Mark Antony Group, and getting back into, you know, Peter, our chief winemaker. He does a lot of work and has been doing a lot of work in Canada. So, you know. Hence, we'll be back in Canada a lot more, and not putting all our eggs in one basket anymore. I guess it's continuing to expand, and we have the global country of origin projects making wines in Napa, China, and Bordeaux now. So to take the pressure off the Australian, so it is Australian winemakers producing wines in all those different countries as well. So
now before we got onto the mic, we were talking about Penfold's expansion around the globe, and not just selling wine, but you were talking about, and it kind of blew us away when you said that Penfold's is not just making Australian wine. You're actually making wine in California, in Bordeaux, and other parts of the world. Can you tell us about that project? Are those projects?
Yeah, I guess it was the gentleman at the time, you know, it wasn't, you know, we lifted which was the CEO, a gentleman called Michael Clark at the time, decided that we'd had vineyards planted in the US and we had lots of facilities around the world that we could use. Let's put Penfolds as a real global player, because we had vineyards already planted from clones here in Australia. So just down the road, and the home of Penfolds at McGill, which was founded in 1844, we took cuttings from those vineyards and put them in the ground in a place called Paso Robles in 1998. So we bought a property in 1996, and then we put vines in the ground from clones or cuttings in Australia in the ground in Paso Robles. So 2006, 7 and 8, we actually made wines in Paso Robles on the central coast of California. But they were deemed not good enough for Penfolds, so they went into our library. And then, in 2017, the gentleman CEO at the time, Michael Clark, wanted to create and craft wines in California. So I went over there in 2017, created a pilot project to see if we could use not only the vineyard we actually had planted, but the facilities that we had actually in Paso Robles. And then in 2018, the green light was given that we would use not only the fruit from Paso Robles, because Paso Robles is more a Rhone region as well, so much warmer, much drier than Napa Valley, 4 hours to the north. So we started the project in 2018 with four different wines. So crafting a high-end wine, very small base, with, you know, high-end Napa Cabernet, and then we did a second tier, a third tier, and a fourth tier using the Syrah that was actually planted. But the top two tier wines are actually called wines of the world. What's a wine of the world? Well, it's actually a wine that's made from Napa Cabernet and Australian Syrah. So we've mixed two hemispheres of wine together in Napa Valley. So we have our vintage or harvest first. We craft the wine and then we blend in different countries, so in the US and in Australia, and then we send a portion of the Australian wine that would be good enough for Penfolds Grange to California and blend in with the Cabernet in California that we've crafted, 6 months later. And then the top two weird tier wines are like that. The second wine is called Bin 149, which is a Napa-only Cabernet. But then we use Australian Cabernet, good enough for what is our top tier Cabernet in Australia. And we send that to the US as well. So we have this coined term, wine of the world. So two hemispheres of wine blended together and then maturated together in Napa Valley, in our cellars in Napa, and then bottled and released to the US market.
So, and is it under the Penfolds name, or is it
absolutely looks exactly the same? Unfortunately, this is a
you've got a pretty bare office.
Yes, yes. So this is only this is not my office. This is just a meeting office.
Gotcha.
No, I do think
that's a neat experiment. Like I said, and what stage of the winemaking is the wine done? So like fermentation's completely finished. This is like what is it transported in barrels? Like is it the barriques that are transported or is it moved?
We actually use stainless steel, gotcha. So you can't really transport oak either through customs. It's wood. So,
interesting.
Yeah, so it's wood. So, yeah, you've got to be really careful on that sort of thing. So, you know, if you did, the wood would have to be fumigated and things like that. So, it's transported in stainless steel. It only takes about 6 weeks. Or if we decide to fly it, we can fly it as well. So, that's obviously only 4 days from point of leaving. So, we do that. We craft wines in Bordeaux and we bring them back the other way and we craft wines that are Bordeaux and Australian-esque as well. So, and then we fly those around the world as well. So they're flown down to Australia. We blend a little bit of Cabernet, potentially Merlot, into Australian Cabernet here as well. We have a partnership as well. We've also, you know, we're also crafting Champagne.
Ah, so there we go. That's my next question for you.
Yeah, we read the label out loud, so everyone listening knows about it. We tasted the rosé champagne yesterday, and when we pulled it out of the box that it was sent to us, Michael was just like, "I said it's champagne." He's just like, "Does it say champagne on the bottle?" I'm like, "Yeah, it says made in France on it."
Yeah,
correct. I was like, no, so it's 2000 not
sparkling wine. He goes, no, it really says champagne. So what is that project that you've got going on?
So we've been doing that. So 2000 and I'm trying to think now. We released a few years ago. We released the 2012. So we actually released 4 champagnes from the 2012 vintage. So we released 2 single champagnes, 2 single vineyards, small. Only 0.4 of a hectare. So what we've got is we've got a partnership with a family called TNA. So TNA is the champagne house in France. They're a sort of new champagne producer in the old world, and we're sort of an old producer in the new world. So the two work really well together. So, yeah, so it's been crafted from the chief winemaker. Our chief winemaker, Peter Gago, has a love of champagne. So... he happened to know Stanislav is the winemaker at TNA, and he had a really fantastic relationship with him. And then we've been able to craft these wines in Champagne via the chief winemaker, and then craft the wine. So we actually started out with, like I said, 4 champagnes, and then we crafted the rosé a year later to bring it into more, more. User-friendly, more affordable style of champagne, which was the rosé. So, because the other champagnes were $280 Australian dollars a bottle, the single vineyard wines, which are much harder and much smaller, obviously, to try and get your hands on. So, really, it started as Penfolds really wanted to do, when we do dinners, we wanted to have champagne. We wanted to have our white wine portfolio, our red wine portfolio, and then our origins, which originally started with Fortified. So you can have the whole experience with just Penfolds now. So you can have your whole dinner party. So whenever you would come to a Penfolds function, we would start with our champagne, move into our whites, reds, and then finish with our, you know, potentially our 20, 30, or 50-year-old tawny ports.
I love what you said about the user friendliness of the champagne, because that was definitely something that Michael and I both observed. Is like, you know, as a wine critic, I've had a hard time really understanding the appeal of a lot of rosé champagne. Like I've tasted some Krug rosé champagne where it's just like, yeah, it's good, but like it's void of any of the like the redness that you get from Pinot Noir. The thing that you really love about rosé, and the thing that that I really loved about the rosé champagne was that it had the red fruit and it had like a little bit of sweetness to balance the tannin. And Michael schooled me a little bit on that part of like the rosé champagne-ness of it. And it's really good. We both really dug it.
And obviously with Peter, the chief winemaker, he had a real fascination. So I guess his fascination, even though he's the chief winemaker of a big group, his love is everything champagne and everything Pinot. And he used to craft, when he first started originally, say 20, 25 years ago, he actually started making the wines at McGill. So a lot of the Pinot we were taking was from the Adelaide Hills. So it is a little bit bolder and a little bit stronger than what we would generally get from places like Tasmania in Australia, which is a little bit sort of it's much cooler climate. It's a tighter structure. It's finer. Whereas the Adelaide Hills Pinots are a little bit more sort of bolder and stronger, and Peter really likes that, enjoys that. So they're not dry red-esque, but they're a little bit firmer and a little bit darker, and they tend to have a little more tannin. So he really definitely likes that style of Pinot and believes bringing that into the champagne mix as well. So that's a real true craft of Peter and his style as well, what he actually likes. So, and that's what he's crafted in the rosé.
So we also tasted some Chardonnay yesterday. Andre, I can see because we can see each other on video.
311.
Audio only. Yep. You had a little bit of Chardonnay there. There's got to be a love of Chardonnay at Penfolds as well. Am I right about that?
Correct. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the 311. And then we've obviously got two higher grade Chardonnays. Aside the one that you're actually drinking now. So,
well, the feather that can go into your cap is that Michael is one of the last remaining members of the ABC Club.
I don't think I'm the last. I think there's tons of us, but that's okay. You keep saying that.
I mean, you know, you surround yourself with enough crazy people and you don't take a look at all the other people who are not around you. I mean, anyways, crazy people is the thesis there. Anyways, Michael actually had nice things to say about the Chardonnay yesterday.
Yeah.
As far as the few Chardonnays that I've tasted out of Australia of late, there seems to be a nice pullback from oak, which used to be a big problem in the 90s, where just oak, you were just hammering Chardonnay with oak completely. That lasted into the 2000s, and it seems as we hit we turn the corner into 2010. There seems to be a change in style in Australia. Is that something I'm dreaming of, or am I just getting used to it? Or has
100% correct. I think when we first started making Chardonnays, you know, quite obviously aimed at a certain market. A lot of those were interjected into the US market. You know, big, you know, yellow, buttery, which I'm not mistaken, probably is still a style in the US from what I've seen personally.
Yes.
It's so still, no, it's still pulling, 100%
it's still
correct.
Pulling back a bit though. It is starting to pull back everywhere a little bit, but I mean, Kistler still exists.
Yes. But I think, you know, and the Mondavis of the world and the Jackson family and some of those wines as well. But I think what you're seeing in the US is potentially a new wave of winemaker as well, which is pulling back on those as well. So they tend to be younger. And, you know, I've looked at quite a few Chardonnays from the coast and Sonoma and Alexander Valley and even further north up in Oregon and Washington. And, you know, they're really pulling back and they're really letting the fruit give more expression, which is what we tend to do here as well. So yeah, really, it was probably in the 90s, the 2000s that we really started to say, well, we're not going down this path. And the white winemaker here, who's been part of Penfolds, he's 38 years. So he's been with the business for 38 years crafting wines. He started in red wine production and then moved across into white wine and now crafts all 100% of our Chardonnays. And he has this real fascination with, you know, tightness and steeliness and picking fruit exceptionally, not exceptionally early, but very early before there's any damage from sun. You know, we've really gone, I think if you look at our first Yatana in 2005, which is our top echelon Chardonnay, you know, it was from McLaren Vale. Now nearly, you know, 90 to 100% of our top-end Chardonnay come from Tasmania.
Hmm.
You know, Tasmania is closer to the Arctic.
You have a vineyard out in Tasmania as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have vineyards wherever there's a place to grow grapes, we have vineyards. And Tasmania is where we're going because it's quite an interesting place because the west coast of Tasmania is quite wet, whereas once you get about halfway through Tasmania, it gets quite dry. But the beautiful thing about Tasmania on the eastern side is where a lot of vineyards are growing. It's cool, but it's not hugely wet. Yes, it has rainfall, but it's not really that wet. It has the same rainfall as we do here, close to the same rainfall as we do here in South Australia. So it's quite dry, but it is beautiful and cool. So it's great for growing grapes, but it's great for growing Pinot and Chardonnay. So most of our Chardonnays now, that 311 that you showed me before,
yep,
was originally from Tumbarumba. So Tumbarumba is the highlands or the snowfields or the snow. So if you would come to Australia during the winter, you would go to places like Tumbarumba, which is the highlands. So it snows in those vineyards. So, you know, higher altitude, cooler climate, beautiful part of the world. So 311 originally started in Tumbarumba. I think 2017, if you got that 311 in 2017, the 311 was actually Tumbarumba on it. But because we've had to expand it, we now use Tumbarumba, Southern Victoria and parts of Tasmania as well. So, yeah, we have beautiful resources of Tasmania, but it's all further south.
Yeah, some of my favorite Pinots out of Australia have come from Tasmania.
Just that
cool climate. And the Chardonnays are beautiful as well. And I've had some sparkling from there as well.
Our Pinot is 100%. So as I was saying earlier, Peter loved the Adelaide Hills Pinot, but it was a little bit more sort of dry reddish and sort of warmer region. Whereas now we've gone to Tasmania, 100% of the Penfolds sort of cellar reserve and the small amounts of Pinot that we actually do make are all 100% Tasmanian now because of the environment, the conditions, and obviously, as we know, things in parts of the world are starting to warm up. So everyone tends to be drifting further south in regions or, you know, in your part of the world, probably going further north.
We obviously don't see enough Penfold wines in Ontario. I you know, wandering through the LCBO, I don't see a lot.
We see the entry level Cab Shiraz pretty regularly, but like that's about it. Like I was really excited to get the wines that were sent to us.
I'd love to try some of these Pinots as well.
We'll see if we can definitely see if we can do something there.
Well, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I'd love to try that. Yeah.
Well, Andrew, I'm sure we could probably keep talking like on and on and on. There was so much information. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to just talk to us a bit about the company and like what's going on. And it was a pleasure to, you know, just get some of the history and some of your history as well. So I want to thank you very much for taking the time.
Anytime, and always feel free to jump on board anytime. I can always give you further updates later in the year. And again, every single year I head to California as well. So, you know, from September, October, November, I'm actually in Napa as well. So
okay, but we gotta get
very
you to,
similar time frame.
We got to get you to Toronto or to Niagara. That's the next thing that we got to get.
No, yeah, he just invited us to Napa with him. So why don't you just take that as the invite?
Hey, we've got a great place in Napa as well, which we use for hanging out with customers as well. So it's right in the heart of Rutherford. So yeah,
ooh,
if you ever do come that way, we can certainly set you up in something which you'd be accustomed to, probably.
Road trip. Well, Andre, that was a lot of fun. Learned a lot of things, and you almost had the story of the Grange correct.
Well, I did. He just had way more details, and that was the thing where
No. The part you said was it was made all in secret. It wasn't made in secret. It was made in 3 years. It was made in secret.
Okay, well, fine. Okay, fine. We want to split hairs on that. I had the important parts of the story. I had the cinematic parts of the story correct. I'm going to take a victory lap on that one.
All right, you do that. Well, that makes you happy.
That was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward for us to talk to Andrew again. And I'm still like surprised that you dug that warm climate Chardonnay.
It was the lowest scoring of the three wines. As I said, I gave it a thumbs up. I don't know. I don't know. I gravitate 100% towards it.
That Cabernet
Sauvignon. Some of that stuff from Tasmania that's going on. I know that one's partially from Tasmania, but I'd love to try one of their Tasmanian origin wines. I think that'd be great.
You know what? I'm going to just like throw it down there is I would love to taste the entire lineup of Penfold's wines. Like it was literally like listening to someone talk about Pokemon cards there. Like how many different wines does Penfold's make? And like just the worldwide experimentation, I think is something that is fascinating. But anyways, we digress. This has been a very long episode. That interview was, we went in with a plan for it to be kind of short and sweet, but Andrew ended up being such a great great talker that we just let it run. So
you had some great stories to tell. So hope everybody enjoyed that. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time
for our 350th episode.
Really? Holy.
Yeah.
Where's the time gone?
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know if we're going to do anything special. We've never really done anything special for the milestones. It sort of popped up with the new podcasting platform we're using. I'm able to track the episode numbers a little bit better. Anyways, if you do want to make sure that we survive for another 350 episodes, help us out on Patreon. Patreon.com/twoguystalkingwine. I'm at Andre Wine Review all over the place. AndreWineReview.ca.
And I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. You can find me as the great guy on most places and Michael Pincus Ryan Review on others. My only question to you, Andre, before we say goodbye is, you know, your first anniversary is paper and then there's cotton and all that. What is 350?
350? Geez, how am I supposed to know that? Who thought we were going to make it this far?
Yeah, whatever. Good night.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes.
Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.